One of the questions that I get asked a lot is, so how can we be sure that shamanism or shamanic techniques existed in pre-Christian times? I'm going to attempt to try to answer that today. So listen on and we'll get into it. You're listening to the Irish Shamanism Show, a podcast all about Irish nature-based spirituality, healing and community. My name's Anna, a native Irish Bamfaza, or woman of knowledge, aka a tribal healer or shamanic practitioner, to give it a more well-known term. I'm also a holistic counsellor and psychotherapist, trainer, and ordained pagan priest and celebrant. In this show, we'll be discussing all things to do with traditional Irish and Celtic healing methods, nature-based spirituality, and what it's like to be a modern Irish pagan. I will also be chatting to some very exciting and interesting members of the wider pagan community for their take on Indigenous spirituality, paganism, traditional healing practices, and many other related topics, issues, and concerns. So thanks for tuning in. Fill your cauldron with your beverage of choice. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Fáilte romhaibh agus beannacht tí. Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of the Irish Shamanism Show. It seems incredible to me that I'm on episode 6 already, and even more so that anybody might be listening to me rambling on about various things to do with shamanism, Irish paganism, etc. So the question that I had today in the pre-introduction was, how can we be sure that shamanism existed or shamanic-like techniques existed in pre-Christian times? A lot of people will really focus on Celtic shamanism or the Celtic times, the Neolithic, really. Although the Celts started around the Mesolithic, they really did come into their own in the Neolithic times. But I want to look even further back to the Paleolithic, and we're going to have a look at some stuff around that. My dog is in the background doing really weird things, so if you hear any funny noises, that's what's going on there. It's not me getting in touch with my animal side, although that could happen too. So, you know, spoiler alert, stick around for the whole show just in case. Before I start saying anything, most, if not all, of what I say is based on my own experience and my own training, both the academic side of my training and also the experiential side of my training. And I have to say that I'm much more of an experience focused type of person rather than an academic type of person. Although I do like to get into the academic side of things, I'm not a really good researcher on my own merit. I like to look into other people's research. And part of the reason for that is that I never really learned how to research properly, because I do think that that's a very fine skill that people have or haven't. But also because I don't speak old Irish. I don't even speak new Irish, modern Irish. I have obviously a couple of focal, a few words, and, you know, a few sentences, even though I went to school and I learned it for 16 years, something along those lines. I am trying to incorporate Irish a lot more into my daily life and into my work as well, because I do think it makes a huge difference. But unfortunately, we have a very troubled and traumatic history with the Irish language in Ireland, in my country. And part of that is due to colonialism and the fact that Irish was seen as a barbaric, dirty, you know, horrible language by our colonizers. And it was literally bet out of us. Our ancestors were severely punished for speaking our language. And along with that came, you know, the guilt and the shame of speaking that language, which was considered to be a very, you know, savage language, a language of the dirty Irish people. We're still very much battling with those that post-colonial trauma in our country in this day, and it's been handed down through our DNA. Now it's starting to change. It definitely is starting to change, but it's very much reflected in the way that, especially for my generation, the way that Irish was taught in our schools and the way that it was thought of amongst the general populace. There are pockets of people in our country that speak Irish and that are fluent Irish speakers. I think that's like 3% of our population, and they're called Gaeltachts, and Irish speaking people are called Gaeilgeors, but that's a very, very small percentage of our population. A very mixed feeling, because up until quite recently, to get into university, you had to pass Irish in your Leaving Cert, which was like the A-level equivalent. But at the same time, as I said before, you know, it was taught really badly in schools, and we didn't really want, I mean, Irish was the class really that nobody wanted to be in, that everybody kind of really hated doing. And even to this day, I try to incorporate a lot more Irish into my daily life, which is still very little, to be honest. And I still get dirty, you know, not dirty looks, but weird looks from people. So it's definitely a really hard subject. It's very layered, and it's very deep. And a massive big no-no is for anybody outside this country, or even within this country, to ever throw shade on an Irish person for not speaking better Irish, or for not speaking more Irish, or for not speaking daily Irish, or even to question it, because you really can't know what that's like unless you've been through it, or, you know, it'd be very hard anyway. And I know that there's other countries who have similar issues with regards to, you know, colonialism and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to say that. And a lot of the texts, the older texts, are in Old Irish. A lot of them are in Old Latin and Greek as well, as our Druidic ancestors were fluent in all those subjects. And the short answer to that question that I posed at the start of this podcast is that we can't know for sure. We just can't, because, as unfortunately, the Druids and the shamanic practitioners of this country, and the people who lived pre-Christian, it was an oral tradition. The bards and the Druids and the Ovates and the Fili and the, you know, the nature-based healers and that sort of thing. Everything was passed down orally. There was a huge tradition on the bardic skills, and that's how teaching was also passed along, and that's how knowledge was passed along. And as I've said before, there was no violent takeover by the Romans of Ireland, even though that did happen elsewhere in Europe. It didn't happen in Ireland because it's a small island country, and the Roman influence really came from England. There was no violent war takeover. It was gently and quite gradually assimilated. So the Druids and the people, the pre-Christian pagans, would have very gently assimilated themselves into this new culture and this new religion, which was made widespread by the Romans. And that means that a lot of that knowledge was lost, and a lot of that wisdom was lost, and a lot of that learning was lost. And a lot of what we do have then would have been written down by people who were very biased against the pagan savages. So the Romans, they literally saw the Celts as savages, as beastly savages, and they were very afraid of the, you know, what the magic that the Celts were doing. And they saw it as pagan superstition. They were, the Romans, if they were anything, were, you know, this epitome of urban sophistication in, you know, in their eyes. So the Celts, who were a nomadic, animistic people who lived close to nature, close to their animals, their life and their spirituality was all very nature-based, the opposite of urban. So they really did see them as savages and as beasts and as, you know, unwashed heathens. And also they were very afraid of the power of their priests and their religions. So it would have been very biased against them. A lot of what was written down would have been very biased against them. And then later on, we had the Christian scribe, and paganism in Ireland still existed until the 7th and 8th centuries. And even after that, to this day, we still have a lot of, you know, customs and traditions that, and superstitions that are observed, that come from our ancestors and come from our more ancient traditions. So we, you know, it's very important to make that point. It's a broken line. So we don't really know what our ancestors were doing when it came to religion and spirituality. But we can make very educated guesses. And there are a lot of hints in the text, as I said, from, you know, Julius Caesar and from the Romans, and then later from the Christian scribes. There are some texts that still exist as well from the Druids, from the Greek and Roman, Latin Druids. Some stuff was written down, and then there was some philosophers that were writing about it as well. And then before that, we have other things that we can look at. And then we also look at the way that there are other cultures around the world, other native indigenous peoples around the world that came from the same kind of Paleolithic hunter-gatherer nomadic people and didn't have that unbroken line, or broken line. They have the unbroken line, and we can look at how their tradition survived. And then we can see as well that there are a lot of commonalities across a lot of the different traditions. So the North and the South Americas, the Northern Europe going into Russia, you know, Siberia, places like that. And then we look as well at, you know, Asia and Africa, the continent of Africa, different things that are going on there. And we can see that, we can see how these things progress. And we can say then, you know, we can make logical assumptions that if that's how it was happening there and across the board, then probably the same would have gone for us in Ireland and in other places in Central and Southern Europe. That's one thing. And the other thing is as well, what we call, you know, spontaneous ancestral recovery of memories. There's a name for it, but I can't remember it right now. Now, I think it's very important to say that we have to be very careful with that, because a lot of bullshit has been sold and written about, claiming to be, you know, this kind of spontaneous ancestral memory, and it's just not. And it's okay for people to talk about that, what they believe, as long as they're not trying to sell it as fact. So along that same vein, we also have what we call UPG, unverified personal gnosis with a G, where, you know, something has come to us through meditation or journey work or messages, and we can say, okay, this is what I believe, and this is what I think, and this is what I have learned through this method, and I can even write a book about it or teach it, as, again, as long as I am honest about the source and I'm not trying to sell it as fact and absolute fact. And on that same vein, even more so as well, is that we have our spirit guides, and shamanism in particular is very, very heavily based on connection and relationship with our spirit guides and with our ancestors. And they do a huge amount of teaching with us. That's fine. It is I believe that it is a very acceptable mode of learning. Again, as long as we're honest about that, and as long as we're not trying to sell it as fact. We did have this resurgence of, you know, interest in older traditions and that around the Victorian times, and even further, a lot of stuff was appropriated and written about and changed and kind of, let's say, romanticized in a way and repackaged as fact. And, you know, I'm looking at you, Lady Gregory, and, you know, Robert Graves as well, further on. And again, you know, a lot of people are reading those books and reading those manuscripts now, and they're saying, okay, this is fact, because it's a bit old, you know, but it's not like old. It's a bit, you know, it's 100 years old or less in the case of Robert Graves, but it's still not fact. And it's, you know, and some of them might even claim to be connected down through an unbroken ancestral line, or, you know, that those, this secret knowledge. And I'm not trying to say that that's wrong or you're not allowed to have that. I'm just saying, don't try to tell me that this is definitely something concrete and fact, because it's not. Just be honest about where it's coming from, and be honest about your sources. Okay. So having said that, the shamanism that I practice personally is a mixture of what I was taught during 6.5 years of training, somebody that I trust 100%, and also my own training then with my guides and how they have led me and what they have taught me and what they've told me, on top of, I won't say quite an extensive, but, you know, I have maybe 15, 20 books on the subject that I've read, not all of them, you know, to various degrees of let's say reliability. And then the, you know, some of the academic research that I have found that other people have done. Again, as I said, I'm not an academic, or I don't pretend to be an academic either. About the word shaman and the word shamanism, that it is a very specific word and term that comes from the Tungus people of Siberia, which is a specific tribe in Siberia, and refers to a specific member of that tribe who does the spiritual stuff. So it's very much a hot word. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, that I would never call myself a shaman. I don't consider myself a shaman. And I would be very uncomfortable if somebody else described me as a shaman or said to me that I was a shaman or I am a shaman. I am not a shaman. What I am is a shamanic practitioner, or even better yet, I do shamanic things. And I'm okay with that, because the word shamanic has been assimilated by the English language. And as English is a living and breathing language, it's being updated all the time. And it's a word that most people can recognize to mean the set of skills or the set of techniques that I do and other people like me do. Do I wish that there was a word that was commonly known in the general populace other than in the very specific niche that I, you know, that I work in? Yes, I do. I mean, and there is, like, there's a word like banfaza, which is the Irish term for woman of knowledge, or farfaza, man of knowledge. There's, you know, the term bandriacht, a female magic worker, or fardriacht, a male magic worker. Magic being the sense of spirituality, magic being in the sense of spirituality. And there are other terms throughout different regions that have their own name for it. Yes, I do wish there was. But at the same time, I'm sure that will happen. But for now, this term, shamanism, is the term that we use to you know, to hint to others the kind of work that we do. As my biggest focus really is about community, I'm also an ordained pagan priest. So it's about working with community, connection with community, service to community. Then it's not much good if I call myself something and 95% of the people around me don't know what the hell that means. Of course I can educate people, and I'm trying to work to educate people all the time. That's why I'm doing these podcasts, but that takes time. So for the time being, I'm okay with saying that I am a shamanic practitioner, a shamanic therapist, you know, that I do shamanic-like stuff. But I'm not a shaman, and I think that's a very important distinction to make. You might have different feeling about it than I do, and that's fine too. You know, as long as you're not trying to appropriate other people's culture and their, you know, their spirituality, that's, you can call yourself whatever you want to, as long as you're honest about the reasons, in my view, about the reasons why, and that you've put some thought into it. And I have put a lot of thought into this. I mean, I'm talking about 10 years worth of, oh, more than 10 years worth of thought into it. So, yeah, there's that. And again, I just wanted to say that because I do think it's important to point that out. I would also like to insert this quote by Tom Cowan in his book, Fire in the Head. We should not let the extended use of the term shaman blur the sharp edges of authentic shamanism, and neither should the purists' usage of the term prevent us from recognizing truly shamanic phenomena appearing in cultural contexts far removed from the Tungus tribes of Siberia. And he goes on to say, we need to be flexible in using the term shamanic experiences and practices, as they are found in almost all native cultures and are currently being revived among modern people. Shamanism is fundamentally a way of viewing reality and a method or technique for functioning within that view of reality. The shaman perceives the universe in different ways from other men and women, and has personal experiences in the universe that seem to transcend those of other people. The core elements of shamanism found in most cultures with a solid shamanic tradition are: 1. Shamans can voluntarily enter unique visionary state of consciousness, during which 2. they experience a journey into non-ordinary realms of existence, where 3. they acquire knowledge and power for their own use or for the use of others in their communities. These 3 features comprise what many shamanic practitioners today call core shamanism. Okay. And I'd also like to read this other quote, which I think is quite relevant. And that is by, let me see, I just have to open that up. Stephen Wolfe, who is a sun dancer and shamanic practitioner of Northern Cheyenne and Irish ancestry. and he's practiced within the Northern Plains spiritual traditions for over 25 years, and he has this to say. These days, everyone seems to have a definition and interpretation of the term shamanism, from the structural anthropologists to the mythologists to the Jungians, the Freudians, the transpersonal psychotherapists, the process-orientated psychologists, to the New Agers with their psychobabble. The academics hold to a strict, rigid definition, feeling they have proprietary rights to the term and smirking at everyone else. On the other hand, New Agers have a definition so broad as to be meaningless. Both sides miss the profound depth and breadth of this particular spiritual way, which is much more than mere technique. Shamanism may possibly be the oldest spiritual path and consequently has far more profound implications for contemporary humans than its academic interpreters realize. The reason for this is that the act of interpretation as a mental exercise, whereas shamanism is a living dynamic that involves all of the senses, a sensuous experience that must be known in a primary and primal way. The mental wheel spinning of academics or the shallow genuflecting of New Age entrepreneurs will never truly comprehend it until they stop interpreting and start experiencing it internally and externally with mind, emotion, body and spirit. Okay. So what do we know about shamanic techniques going back into history? We do know that shamanism was probably the oldest known spirituality known to mankind. We know that the later Mesolithic and the Neolithic people of the region that I'm living in were also called the Celts, and that the Celts is a very umbrella term of a mixture of a lot of different tribes of very different peoples, with a similarity of language, some culture, some beliefs and traditions, and some mythology. But there's no such thing as the Celtic people, because they just weren't that organized. They just weren't that same. There was just so many of them, and they were all so different. So going back even further to the Paleolithic people, the hunter-gatherers, societies, we know that there are cave paintings, in particular around the Cresswell Crags, that are over 13,000 years old, and they depict people lying on the ground, seemingly asleep or maybe dead, with, you know, animals around them, and they'd also, kind of floating above them. They depict people kind of turning into animals, and, you know, they depict stuff to do with the elements and to do with the cycles of the year and the sun and the moon. So we know that these like trance-like states, altered states of consciousness, would have existed back then. We know that these Neolithic barrow mounds, standing stones, stone circles, carved rocks, which are thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, depicted shamanic-like techniques. And we know that there are, you know, burial sites, and there are offerings within these burial sites and burial mounds that also depict shamanic-like ceremony. And archaeology, both in the British Isles, the island of Ireland, is coming up with new things all the time, new findings all the time. And moving a bit further forward in history, we know that the Celts had a complete system of magic and spirituality, and one that was highly respected by the ancient world. It's reported that Clement of Alexandria and Diodorus said the Celtic priests of Gaul trained with Pythagoras in mystical philosophy. And in the first century AD, Dio Christosome equated the Celtic spiritual practitioners with the Persian Magi, the Indian Barams, and Egyptian priests. So there was some stuff that was written down, and some stuff by the early Celts themselves, and as we said before, a lot of stuff by the Roman and Greek philosophers and the Caesars and the people who were documenting what was happening at the time, which of course was heavily biased. A lot of the early pagans in Ireland, in this part of the world, assimilated into the early Christian religion when that took over. And right up to the 7th and 8th centuries in Ireland, we still practiced paganism very strongly. And then early Christianity really did assimilate paganism. And a lot of the Druids would have really converted into Christianity and become Christian priests, Christian scribes, that kind of thing. So they would have then gone on to probably write about some of the practices. Maybe, maybe not. We don't really know. But we do know that there was documents made by early Christian scribes as well. The pagan practices, which shamanism would have been seen as part of and would have been seen as anti-Christian practices. So they would have been depicted in quite demonic ways and quite barbaric ways. There are a lot of shamanistic elements easily found within a lot of very old writings, and a lot of these elements were quite common within the different cultures around the world, and they included descriptions of practitioners and practices and ceremony and magical initiations, very heavily leaning towards ancestor worship, spiritual healing. There's a very heavy lean towards healing when we talk about kind of modern shamanism or neo-shamanism, let's say. But there's some evidence that shamanism in more ancient times, sorry, you can probably hear my dog scraping in the background, Pringles, good girl, shamanism would have been used for other things such as shamanic hunting, or even what we would call maybe dark shamanism or shamanic warfare. Whereas nowadays we have a very heavy, as I said, leaning towards shamanic healing and community shamanism. Then we look at these other commonalities, such as enchantment and a big move towards shape-shifting and animistic beliefs that all things have soul and all things have spirit. Talking to birds and animals, that idea of soul flight, journeying, walking between worlds, and that idea of connection with spirit, that idea of spirit guides, spirit helpers, spirit allies. We also see a lot of seership or distance viewing, oracleship, oracle speaking, talking to birds and animals within journeys, and then wisdom gained by, say, divination or trance work, philosophies brought back from discourses with spirit. We see tools being used across the board as well, although very commonly when we think of shamanism, we think of drums and the drum being used. I use it myself. I have a feeling that probably it was used by our ancient ancestors, but we don't have any proof of that. And I think, why not? I mean, they were hunter-gatherers. They were, you know, they would have had animal skins, and they would have certainly had the knowledge and the ability to stretch those skins over wooden frames. So why wouldn't they have used drums for trance work? Although, as I said, we've no proof of any of that. But my own personal view is that I think they probably would have been, you know. We do have some evidence, in inverted commas, from some of the folklores and mythology that something like the silver branch would have been used for trance work. The silver branch being the branch with the nine bells on it. And there are stories that have endured to today about the use of the silver branch for change and for magic within these stories. So it was definitely used as a tool, and also things like the staff, the crane bag, the wand, the rattle. And even across more traditional shamanic cultures, we see lots of other instruments being used as well to help dance, voice, singing. And more than anything, what we really see is a deep connection with nature and the natural world around. Connection with all beings, and particularly all natural beings. It's a very practical and nature-centric belief and spirituality. And as the Paleolithic, the Mesolithic, the Neolithic people, we're all very centered around nature and around natural living. It's not a big jump to make that it was also part of early Irish or Celtic shamanism, whichever one you want to call it. Geoffrey Gunce, who was an Irish scholar, he observed that all Celtic art has a tension between reality and fantasy. So again, that kind of liminal feeling of having one foot in this world and one foot in the other world. And we know that there's a very heavy lean towards animal transmogrification or shape-shifting in a lot of the old stories and a lot of the old mythologies and the folklore that's been passed down through the years. Even the most knowledgeable being in the stories is a fish, the salmon of knowledge, you know. And then we see like stories like the children of Lir, where they were turned into swans. And we see stories of the Selkies, people who could shapeshift between the human form and the form of seals. One of the goddesses of sovereignty of Ireland is the Morrigan, who was a shapeshifter as well. Normally took the form of a crow or a raven, but sometimes a wolf or an eel, also cow as well. And who knows how many other forms. We see stories of Fionn Mac Cuil, who would have lived and trained and worked with his Fianna, his band of brothers, in the wilderness and very close to animals, very close to nature. And stories also very heavily centered around traveling to other worlds and bringing back knowledge, bringing back gifts, doing hero tasks, all that sort of stuff. And then a lot of the stories, the horses are seen as the spirit guides between this world and the other world. Also deer, birds, and lots more. So there's a lot of hints in the mythology and the folklore about shamanistic practices as well. Within the Irish context, we do know that ancestor worship is very important, was and still is very important to the Irish and to the people of this land. It's one of the most important forms of worship that we have, as well as the worship of the Éisí, the people of the fairy mounds, the good neighbours, the other crowd. And we have so many stories, even relatively recent ones, of people who are walking home from somewhere and they fall asleep in the wrong place, maybe within or near a fairy circle, and they wake up in the other world where time moves differently, and they come back and 100 years have passed and all the people that they knew and loved are dead. And also stories of bargains being made and never turning out the way that the human people want. So there's that juxtaposition between the other world being a place of beauty and amazement, but also a very dangerous place. And the same going for the people that we find there, who are able to cross between that world and this world. So I think that's really all I have to say about that for now. There is no absolute firm evidence that our ancestors were practicing any form of shamanism, and they certainly weren't calling it shamanism. That is a very new and modern term for this part of the world, though it goes back centuries and probably thousands of years for the Tungus people in Siberia. It has become synonymous with the type of work that we do. For good or for bad, there are those of us who are trying to work towards changing that. But as we know, change takes quite a long time. And to be honest, there's even a lot of people who don't know what shamanism is. In my next episode, I will be talking about spirit guides and who or what are they within the Irish tradition that I would have learnt about and that I feel that I know best within my own tiny little circle and orb of knowledge, which is absolutely minuscule, but it's what I have and what I know. I hope you found some of this interesting. I hope I didn't just ramble too much. I came into it as prepared as I felt I could be. I'm sure there was a lot that I missed or I may have said wrong, but you know what? That's okay too. I can live with that. And if there is anything that you would like me to revise or to think about, please do let me know. I'm very open to learning as I move forward. And you only know what you know when you know it. And when you know better, then do better. So I'm going at this from what I know now and how I know it, based on the knowledge and the research and the people around me that I have now and the tools that I have in my toolbox. I'm very open to improving all of that. I might have made some very blatant factual mistakes, which is certainly a possibility. My next episode, episode 7 of the Irish Shamanism Show, I will be looking at who or what are spirit guides, how I personally work with them, how they can come into our life. And then the episode after that, I'm going to guide a short journey to meet a spirit guide or to deepen your relationship with a guide if you already have one. Thank you so much for listening, and please do like, share, subscribe so that you don't miss any further episodes, which I hope you don't want to, but you may wish to. And I look forward to speaking to you again in the next episode. Slán agus beannacht.